Thank you very much. I'm Count Zero from the Cult of the Dead Cow, and 1984, 20 years ago, Cult of the Dead Cow got together and started releasing all of our T-files, all of our crazy text files, not just about hacking, but also just kind of celebrating creative writing in general, you know, writing crazy shit that you'd never read anywhere else. And but over the years, we've done a lot of different things, and we've been pretty crazy. We've been kind of, a little crazy. You know, I don't know if you remember the Hope where we had the cows and the skulls and the naked wrestling going on. Yeah, that was pretty intense. But we like to sort of, we have a large spectrum of interests. And, you know, we're interested in having a good time, getting crazy, getting a little nuts. But we're also interested in, trying to change the world a little bit, making it more interesting, maybe making it a little bit better. So a few years ago, we started getting involved in hacktivism. And as most people probably know now, hacktivism is the idea of using hacking techniques applied to activism. And actually, we did invent the name hacktivism. Yeah, yeah. Omega in CDC invented the term hacktivism. So every time you say the word hacktivism, we get a quarter. It's awesome. It's really great. So what we have up here now is we don't have any naked wrestling, unless these guys want to get into it later. But what we actually have is a fantastic panel of people to talk about hacktivism. And this is a really fantastic opportunity. And the guy in the CDC who's been really spearheading all of this and being the binding force behind all of our efforts in hacktivism is Oxblood over here. So what I'm going to do is turn it over to him. And he's going to turn it over to them, and they're going to turn it over to you. So that's it.
Thank you. Just one announcement before we get going. I'm not pleased to make this announcement, but Eric Grimm, who is sitting on our panel, is an attorney, and he's been representing a lot of hackers, 2,600, I believe, also. He's staying in a hotel here. He left his door slightly ajar and turned his back, and moments later, somebody lifted his computer out of his room. I'm really hoping it's not somebody here or somebody associated with the conference. I also fully realize... But it's possible that somebody might know something about this or might have seen something or heard something, whatever. It is a Dell laptop in a aluminum Halliburton case. So if anybody does have any information about this or anything that might help Eric get his computer back, that would be fabulous. So you could speak with an organizer or Eric directly, and that's great. On a more pleasant note, it is, in fact, our 20th anniversary, and we've seen a lot of groups come and go in the hacking scene. One group consistently has been there, fellow travelers, friends, and at a time when the administration, current administration of this country, is exporting a lot of fear into the world, this group has consistently exported hope. And we'd like to thank 2,600 and Emmanuel. As Zero said, we've been working with hacktivism, mostly because we invented it, but it has, in fact, gone out, and there are many flavors. Some people claim to be hacktivists or doing hacktivist things or developing hacktivist apps. But we have a very clear definition of what we believe hacktivism to be. For us, it is using technology to improve human rights across electronic media. Hacktivism, the subgroup within the CDC that's been doing a lot of work in hacktivism, has been primarily interested in opening up the internet in these so-called firewalled countries through developing applications or working with grassroots organizations, and the human rights community. For us, technology and human rights go together. That is hacktivism in our view. If other people are doing other things, then I'm not really sure what to call it. It could be cyber activism or digital dissidents or whatever it is, but in our view it isn't hacktivism. There are certain even tactics that we think are appropriate. For instance, Zero's mentioning that we started off by writing a lot of T files, and that was really the first sort of incarnation or mandate of the CDC, and it was really all about free speech. And then when we started working with hacktivism and trying to, you know, get past all of these firewalls, a lot of people couldn't figure it out. You know, we're supposed to be a bunch of goofy guys who write files like Sex with Satan and Bunny Lust and the gerbil feed bomb is my particular favorite, the first file. And so what does that have to do with opening up the internet? Well, there really is a straight line from free speech to somebody being able to hear your free speech. So the T files and the application development or the other work we're doing in hacktivism does go very clearly together. And it's interesting that we never really knew where this was going to go, like so many things, when it was started. It was about 8 years ago we started wrestling around with these ideas, and for 6 years, very actively working. It started out with a few people in the CDC, a few friends. Increasingly, Hacktivismo has grown to be an international hacking organization with members in North America, South America, People's Republic of China, India, Australia, Iran, Japan, Russia. It truly is an international organization, and we set out to make it that way because the internet is an international communications medium that everybody should have access to. One interesting thing I think that the CDC has done is to try to bring hackers and the human rights community together. I don't know if anybody here made it to DEF CON about 3 years ago. We had Dr. Patrick Ball, then the Deputy Director of Human Rights for the American Association for the Advancement of Science, came to DEF CON, and we were up on a sweltering hot roof with as many people for about 2 hours, and the place was just like a hothouse. It was brutal to sit up there, and hardly anybody left because Patrick just held the audience. It was just like so incredible to have a speaker like that come and to talk to hackers in their own language. And a very bizarre and amusing incident came out of that. As some of you know, Patrick essentially gathered the forensic evidence that brought Slobodan Milosevic to trial. He tied all the threads together. He's a statistician, and he managed to find all of the points that pointed the finger to Milosevic. And as a result of that, Milosevic was arrested and is currently, his trial has been ongoing for a couple of years. Patrick went and testified against Milosevic after he appeared at DEF CON as a guest of the Cult of the Dead Cow. And of course, Milosevic was representing himself. And Patrick testified against Milosevic, and then Milosevic had the right to cross-examine him. And his first question was, "So, Dr. Ball, what can you tell me about this dead cow cult?" So you guys may be in for, so you never know what's going to happen in your future.
There's the videos result. Floating around on the internet somewhere.
You can actually see it.
Dead cow cult.
So I've been talking about hacktivism for quite a few years now, and rather than have me spew on, and many people hear many of the things I've said before, I wanted to bring together a distinguished panel of experts, all from different fields and all looking at this phenomenon from different perspectives. It is my great pleasure and high honor to introduce this panel, Sharon Hom, who is the Executive Director of Human Rights in China, Eric Grimm, who was in private practice but is now with, I hope I pronounced it.
Still private practice.
Okay.
Just not solo practice.
He's not solo practice now. Caligaro and Myring, PC, I believe, in Taylor, Michigan. Jagdish Parikh, who is an internet strategist with Human Rights Watch. And Nart Villeneuve, Director of Technology for the Citizen Lab, Monk Center for International Relations at the University of Toronto. Each panelist will speak for about 20 minutes or so. At the end, we'll have a QA, and it's going to be great. So, Sharon, please.
Oxblood, I'm a little shorter than you. Okay. Thank you. I want to especially thank you for including us on this panel, and I'd like to publicly thank you for the support you've been giving to our work for a number of years now, and we really look forward to working together. Is it up?
Yeah.
No? No. Okay. Thank you. Okay. I originally had a different title for the talk, and I was really The Rise of the Internet in China, a cautionary tale, comma, a narrative of hope. I think I'm going to focus more on the theme of technology and human rights. Okay. I want to start with communication technologies. And printing press, telephone, internet, radio, cell phone, fax machines, all of these communication technologies have, most recently, fax machines. You can see the power of that, particularly in the 1989 crackdown in China. But for our purposes today, I'm going to talk a bit about internet as an example of a technology and some of the issues around that with respect to human rights work, what my organization does. Human rights. And what I mean by human rights, it's not an abstract. I'm talking about the principles and norms that have emerged primarily post-World War II. These are the principles and norms that have emerged so that the world could be safe for democracy and peace, and has now become part of a whole system of institutions and processes, primarily in the UN and other bodies. And stakeholders, a word I hate but is a word that is used in our field, refers to the people, the groups that are active in human rights, and this means it includes governments, it includes NGOs like ours, non-governmental organizations, it involves other civil society actors, it also involves, as we all knew, multinational corporations, and then it involves a whole host of other associated, like research, think tanks, etc., the media, etc., etc. So when I talk about communication technologies and the internet and human rights, I'm talking about these whole clusters of processes and peoples and actors and ideas. Okay. And out of this connection, what I'd like to begin and end with is an invitation, an ongoing invitation, for us to think about ways in which we can together build more effective alliances of conscience, because that's what's called for. Those of us involved in human rights work, and those of you in the hacker community that has been involved in working with us, you know what I'm saying. The cards are stacked against us. When we talk about China, China is, if not the holy grail for hackers, I won't be presumptuous to tell you what your holy grail is. China must certainly be one of the most important holy grails for hacking. Because if you can hack China, if you can help us break open China, you have done more than just China. You've done something really major for more than 1.3 billion people in China. It's going to affect the world. So partly what I'm asking today is to ask you to join us. Even the odds. And come on our side, because we're like this, small NGO communities, limited resources, limited, by and large, low-tech techies, and we desperately need you, and because that's what's going to even it against an incredible alliance of global capital, of multinational corporate profit interests, a very powerful police state that is now in an increasingly post-9/11 world, has been able to very successfully, opportunistically exploit the rhetoric of anti-terrorism. And I must have to say the U.S. is making it quite easy for them. They've raised the bar. Now the Chinese can say, don't talk to us about human rights violations. Guantanamo Bay, Iraq, and then there's silence. Because what are we to say after that? So it is a very serious, dismal, serious challenge that we face. And so I want to call for us building even more effective alliances. And I've only been here today. I've just got back from out of the country, so I'm a little bit jet-lagged. But it was so exciting just to see all of you and hear all of you talking in the hallways. And I said, yeah, this group can join this. This group can do something. Okay. Okay. I'm going to do a very quick overview of what I think is, I will call it the conventional story. And it's a story you probably read about in the Western media. It is primarily the dominant story that's being pitched by China, which I will call the, you know, the infrastructure people. Some of you who might be familiar with the World Summit on Information Society, that's supposed to be this discussion about the future of the information society in the 21st century, that is dominated by the infrastructure people who are focusing on some of the things that I'm going to quickly go over. So what I want to do is just go through the conventional story, and then I'd like to interrogate it and take it apart a little bit and ask the more important question. Okay, first of all, you'll hear this a lot. You know, China's internet users, who are they? They're now over 79.5 million online. But this is only 6.2% of the 1.3 billion people and growing. But who's online? Predominantly young, male, and college-educated or with education, and predominantly located in urban areas. 77.6% earn less than 2,000 yuan, which is 250 U.S. But that's a misleading stat also, because why they're earning less than 2,000 yuan or 2,000 Chinese dollars is because they're supported by their parents. So these are primarily students. So it looks like they're in an economically lower class, but in fact they're not. They're part of the most special elite privileged in China, a very small percentage that make it to get an education. Okay. When you look at the gender breakout, you'll see that the gender breakout is that even though you see it sort of leveling off, it's primarily male. And from 1997, when the internet really kind of took off in China, it was 87% male users, and in 2004, it's really evening out a little bit at about 60%, 60.4% male. Okay. In terms of their education, you can see this. And what would have been interesting, this is a stat that perhaps some of we will be doing at HRIC in follow-up with our work on education, is that if you take this and map this against who gets educated in China, this is going to look even more revealing. In other words, this is just looking at who of the percentage of users and what their educational background is, and what you can see from the pie chart primarily is that most of the people online have a basic education or higher, junior college, bachelor, you know, et cetera. Okay. From 1997 to 2004, well, the picture speaks for itself, right? You had 620,000 people online in 1997, and now you have 79.5 million. Needless to say, you can see it is growing astronomically. What do they call it? You know, exponentially. And but what does that mean? Okay. Eh? It's also growing not just in the number of internet users. It's growing from the .cn, the registered domain names. And if you look at the registered domain names, the increase from 1997 was from 4,066 registered to 2004, 340,040 registered .cn domain names. But this is the, from another perspective, not from the perspective of numbers, not from the perspective of these, you know, usually in breathtaking terms. If you read about lots of the Internet in China studies or books or articles, this is what you get. It tends to be this breathy, wow, look at China, millions and millions. Everyone's wired. It's online. It's joining the 21st century. You get this kind of breathless account and awe of technology in China. But against another perspective, if you look at it from the perspective of human development, this is another mapping, and this is what it looks like. If you look at the green areas, that's the so-called high development areas. And when we say human development, we're talking about life expectancy, literacy, healthcare, all of the basic indicators, right? This is how it's measured. If you see the yellow, sort of yellow areas, that's what they call medium development. But I just want to point out how deceptive that is as well. This comes from the UNDP, the United Nations Development Program, their stats. Take a look at Xinjiang, which, as you know, the Chinese are now calling the hotbed of terrorism, and they're really cracking down in terms of executions, and these have been really rising. And anything that goes under the ambit, anyone attempt to assert cultural identity in Xinjiang is being labeled terrorist. So an attempt to perhaps to maintain the Uyghur language, history, religion, practices is being met with a label of splittist and terrorist and anti-China. So how is it that Xinjiang, one of the poorest ethnic minority areas in China, gets to be medium development because of the massive colonization that has been taking place and that has displaced the ethnic minorities? I am ethnically Han Chinese. So my group is the vast majority. We are 96% of the ethnic groups in China. And I had a chance to backpack and go to the desert in Xinjiang as a Han Chinese woman, which people thought was a really stupid, dangerous thing to do. Fortunately, I didn't know that at the time till I came back from the desert. And they said that was a stupid thing to do. But it was really interesting because I got to see firsthand just the devastation. And when you move further out, you see a city that had been 75-80% Uyghur is now 75-80% Han Chinese. So what has happened with colonization, in addition to the massive deployment of PLA troops in the region, they're garrisoned there. These are military troops that are garrisoned there permanently. They have made a major infusion of money for the infrastructure so that the central government in Beijing can say, look, we're developing the outer regions. They're not developing for the locals. They're developing it for the Han colonists who have colonized the area. And so it's quite complex, but that's just a quick. Now, if you look at the vast majority of China, it is less developed. And less developed, as you're going to see, is a real euphemism. Okay. The bandwidth, I wanted you to take a look at this because it's kind of interesting, because it looks like bandwidth, except for a little bit of July 2002 and then sort of in January 2003, when there was some massive industry restructuring and also restructuring of the ministries responsible for overseeing the development of the internet, you see essentially a growing up curve in bandwidth in China. And I just want to say a couple things about that. One, the demand for increased speed and greater bandwidth has come from inside China, which is both a sign of hope and something very interesting for in terms of being able to be exploited. It's come from various sectors. It's come from the government themselves. It's come from the academics. It's come from the business community. It's come from these main sectors because they want the fast connectivity and they need it to the outside. But what happens is the government is trapped between needing to have the broadband access and the speed and connectivity to enable it to globally integrate and become part of the world, WTO, accession, etc., and for them to be able to work with their outside governments and partners and businesses, etc., and the absolute need that the government sees to control the internet, control the content, control who's on it, and to in every aspect. And every time they try to put further surveillance and control and content filtrations and putting it at all the different routing systems, they're slowing it down. So you go through routing systems, you know, you've slowed down the traffic. And that's a very interesting tension between the government trying to control, which results in slower speeds, and this incredible domestic consumer driven and government and business need to have the speed. The second thing about that that's interesting is that it's also coming from outside of China to have this greater access and speed, and that's coming from all of the international global communities that's working with China. Okay. If you look at the access to the internet, a vast percentage of it is coming from home. Now, home access, that you should read as coded as class, economic privilege, economic elites. Because to be able to have a computer, that you can have at home and that you can pay for the connectivity and the line, whether it's land lease or high speed, which many people are getting, means that you can afford it. This is primarily in the larger cities. The largest percentage, if you take a look at the Internet Cafe, that's only like 20%. Now, you may have read a great deal about Internet cafes being shut down, and this is all I want to say about that. There's a disproportionate impact on poor, migrants, workers in smaller cities and rural areas. So when you hear about the shutdown of the Internet cafes, it's not affecting the people who have access at home and who actually are better off. It's affecting the much lower, poorer people. So that's really important. And one of that calls for is that we need greater granularity in our understanding when we look at the development of the Internet and when we hear about surveillance and censorship, that it has a disproportionate impact that's located in very concrete material realities. This is based on a survey that the China Internet Network Information Center, CNNIC, did based on data from January 2004, and they posted, you know, a survey on their website, and they got over 49,653 responses. And so a lot of these responses are based on 16,760 valid responses. And they also did some face-to-face and survey data. But so some of this you're going to see is based on all that. You see a large percentage saying that they use it for what? They use it for getting information. Second large percentage, they use it to be entertained. And then there's a little bit of studying, making friends, and then you have some jumping on bandwagons, some weird shit like that, you know. But the important thing is, what does it mean that they're getting information in a society, in a context, in a culture where the information is already controlled, where the spin on it and the story about it is already controlled, and where the government actually, through a very careful system, which I'll talk a little bit more about, but we just issued a report. Unfortunately, it's only in Chinese now, and the first two chapters of our report is on media censorship in China, is available online at our website, and you can get the first two chapters. And it's a report on how they actually tell you not only what can't be said, but they actually tell you what can be said. And not only what can be said, they tell you the words you have to use to say it. In other words, it is highly contested whether you refer to Taiwan as a, province of China versus Taiwan, period. And it becomes extremely, really, you could get your whole paper shut down because you forgot to put province of China or something like that. So the access to information raises very important fundamental questions about information to what. And what is all that spin about that? The second thing here is just to point out is that there's a real question, those of you who are doing research on China, when you see surveys and when you see data from the surveys, particularly official surveys done by China, we think it's useful because it gives us some kind of a baseline. And normally for torture statistics and all the work that we do, we know those numbers are vastly underreported. So when you look at some of these studies, those of you who are doing this area, you have to also say, let's look at the methodology. And in a pervasive culture where there's fear and reporting, like, what does it mean to answer these surveys? Like, what does this possibly mean? And to really keep that skeptical, I don't need to tell hackers, you know, maintain a skeptical attitude towards authority, but I'll just say that now, you know, okay. Maintain, especially the Chinese government, it's like, be afraid. Be very careful. Okay. This is also just some reasons that were given for not using the net. And that, I think, is important because you see the largest percentage is they don't know how to use a computer. And they don't know anything about the Internet. So when we think of the computer and technology, particularly Internet, as this democratizing force, we have to start with people who say, what? What's a computer? Now, we don't even know what the Internet is. Right? So I think we need to, and they don't have the equipment, which also you can code as class and privilege and money. Okay. Well, there's a debate that goes on, and there's lots of studies of which I will not rehearse or repeat. I'm just going to summarize it in this next couple of frames, because I don't think the debate to me is real interesting. And the debate has to do with, is technology a democratizing force or is it a tool for repression? And our view working in the field is we don't have the luxury of that intellectual debate. We think it's both. We think it's both and in different percentages. We think it sometimes helps each other. Sometimes we think it's intention. Sometimes we think it's productive conflict. Sometimes we think there's a ripple effect you can't even predict. And so that's my view about that debate. But in terms of technology's promise, I would say that at least it can function, not necessarily inevitably, but it can be a democratizing force. It can be a powerful tool for creating a virtual community of activists, both inside China and outside. And in fact, it's not can be, has started to create such a community. And finally, it can be, from the perspective of the government in particular, a powerful tool for global economic integration and cultural integration. You can read that as cultural imperialism or welcoming the genes and the music and the film and the CD and the videos. And I put that down as a positive promise because I think as activists and as human rights activists, we can exploit that. However, the promise, this, also has dangers. And yes, it's a democratizing force, but as the government has shown, by investing and throwing hundreds of millions, and I think even we can't even get a figure on this, I would venture it's probably in the billions of dollars and resources, it has become a very powerful tool of repression, propaganda, and authoritarian control. That's what technology can do. We can talk about biometrics. We can talk about systems that are operational in China. We can talk about now the police stations that have linked all their computers. We can talk about digital cameras that are now in Tiananmen Square. We can talk about them matching faces. We can talk about within 48 hours, they can catch a dissident that left one train station and catch within 48 hours a facial recognition matchup in another. This is all built by, and I know that there was a debate, and I don't want to get flamed immediately, but that it is an infrastructure that has been built with and been profitable to a vast foreign corporate community. And they continue to do so, particularly in the lead-up to the Olympics. And they have bid for, and they are the builders for the security system for the Olympics. And they have gotten the construction contracts, and they're building it now. And from our perspective, of course, we have to protect the athletes. But I think from the human rights perspective, we're asking this question. Are you leaving behind an even more powerful architecture of control and surveillance and just giving them the state of the arts? So the last thing is on global economic integration. What has really happened, and this is, I think that as a lawyer and as a human rights activist, when I face economists and the corporate community, they usually treat us like we're like making soft arguments, like we're not scientific, like we're not empirical. So what they say instead is free markets, marketization, privatization, you know, economic liberalization, and that's inevitably going to be a trickle-down effect that's going to result in greater social justice, blah, 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 for the vast majority of the people. Well, it's bizarre. It didn't work here. Trickle-down didn't work here. Why would it work in China or any place else in the world? Since when have people... Since when did economic or political elites get all the goods and decide, gee, we'll share it? Like willingly. Duh, you know? Like it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. So this argument that you'll hear, and most recently, stupidly, on the front pages of the New York Sunday Times, I had to get it in because I didn't have time to write the op-ed, is that, you know, the creation of a growing middle class in China, 6 million right now, is going to result in greater democratization in China is garbage. It's not going to result in it. The only time it's going to result in greater democratization is that the masses of the people are going to have to organize and demand it, and they're going to get it ourselves. It will not come from an elite. And so the reality of uneven economic development is the reality. I'm going to just give three quick examples of what I mean by the pervasive infrastructure problems in China. And one is has to do with the legal system. There's been a lot of fanfare, a lot of attention, and a lot of foreigners working in China, you know, about legal reforms and saying that China has rewritten laws thousands and thousands of laws that's supposed to improve administrative, you know, due process, and you have a right to a lawyer, you have a right to a phone call even, you have a right to see the evidence against you, etc., etc. Most of these occurred in 1997. And Human Rights in China, we did a three-year study where we tracked actual cases. And you can get that on our website. It's called Empty Promises. And we have names and we have the cases. And you see overwhelmingly in the politicized cases, state security, state secrets, all of those cases, counter-revolutionary, hooliganism, that would be all of you, hooligans, you know, who just refuse to, like, listen. Those cases, over and over, you'll see in the chart, no lawyer, no counsel, did not see the evidence, did not have the family visit, over and over and over. So we think it's really important that when you look at what supposedly has been happening, that's just the picture on the books. It's not the reality. And in terms of due process, the vast majority of executions, the highest number, when you think about the high number of executions, I sometimes get met by Americans who say to me, so we have the death penalty in this country. I said, yes, this is true. But we're talking about in China where there's almost no system. In other words, you're not talking about a lawyer and getting a right to appeal. You don't even get to be on death row, because death row may last exactly 24 hours. It's not years of appeal. So I think it's extremely serious, the high rate of executions in China. And secondly, the lawyers, the defenders of the human rights defenders, are now coming under attack. And now there are at least, according to Chinese lawyers who are documenting this, over 300 criminal defense lawyers who have been attacked. And what do we mean by attacked? We mean that they're then charged with bogus, trumped-up charges. Then they're intimidated. And most importantly, you have a lawyer who was the head of the Committee to Protect Lawyers, the Independence of Lawyers of the Beijing Bar, and he gets put in the slammer for really trumped-up charges. And it's important that Chinese lawyers have come to the defense of these. There's one lawyer that Human Rights in China has been working with, and he represented over 300 cases of people who have been forced out of their homes. And so he's really quite sophisticated, quite an activist, and a hero. He faxed us some information that had been public. He attempted to fax. It didn't get through. But because they had all the records on the fax machine, he was then charged with leaking state secrets, notwithstanding the fact that it had been reported in a newspaper that was irrelevant. And he was sentenced to 3 years. Lost the first appeal. He's now doing other appeals. You can go to our website, and there's a legal campaign now being mounted by us with American lawyers and some Hong Kong lawyers, and also with the UN Independence of Judges and Judiciary Special Rapporteur. We are trying to work on getting him released. And it is really important that when a system starts attacking the lawyers who are supposed to be protecting people's rights, we are really at quite a very dangerous point. The other thing is, separate from the regular court system, you have a whole system of what we call administrative detention. That means no process at all. No charge, no process, nothing. Years. And one example I want to give is reform through labor. That is, you know, you get re-educated through labor. And by the government statistics alone, they have admitted 200,000 a year are detained under this system. And if you don't behave inside, they'll just add another 2 or 3 years, and it'll just, you know, go on and on. Public health. I think the U.S. population is between 350 million to something. 700 million rural inhabitants have no basic, nothing, health care. And then you're talking about a huge AIDS epidemic. And so you can imagine what happened during the SARS outbreak as well. So you're talking about a total collapse under market reforms, privatization, a total collapse of health care, basic primary health care. And you have a projected 10 million infections in China on HIV/AIDS. Extremely serious. Public education, I just wanted to give a quick, because we are working very hard on issues with respect to children, and particularly migrant children. It's an estimated 120 to 140 million migrants in China. These are people that are just moving, floating population. And out of that, we've documented at least 1.8 million children who have no basic education, and that means they're relegated to a life condemned, right, to the bottom of the bucket. I want to say something about, like, when we talk about technology and we talk about the internet, let's just get down to some real where the rubber meets the road. Electricity, phones and running water. And what you see is, in the western provinces, which is Xinjiang and all the poor provinces, only 9.1% have even running water. And telephones, only 9.2%. And these numbers are underreported, because these are the numbers you get officially. Yeah? And then you have electricity, which looks like they have electricity, but having lived and worked a great deal in China over the last 18 years, everyone just takes it for granted. It's Tuesday. There's no electricity. But I wouldn't know that. I would go and teach, and then suddenly I'd be doing a training program, and then we're all in the dark. And nobody seems upset except me going, hello? Where is everybody? What's happening? And they all say, oh, it's Tuesday. There's no electricity. That's how we say it. Tuesday, Thursday, other days, you know. So you're really talking about, even if there's electricity, there's a real question of how stable, how often, you know, how, you know, really it is. Yeah. Eh? So I want to get back to saying, okay, so this is all the technology, which looks breathtaking when you look at the infrastructure numbers. But then when you look at the real uneven development realities, I want to come back to China's human networks. And this might be Oxblood's H2H network. And if you look at these are all the groups that I would identify as, despite incredible odds in China, incredible risks, incredible threats and dangers, these groups are all still working, and many of them work with us underground. So you have the Chinese NGOs. There are a lot of gungos, which are like these fake NGOs. But there are also emerging these really independent NGOs, and we try to work with those groups directly and indirectly. There are the workers, massive problems with labor. You don't read about in the major press the hundreds of thousands of people who protest, workers who protest, the corruption, the millions of dollars of back pay that just closed up. And I had a friend tell me that people just cried at a shoe factory because they went into work and then they were just told, get what you can because the factory's closing down. So they each get like 10 or 15 pairs of shoes and that's the end of it. And when they sell those on the street, it's over. They have no social safety network. But these are the groups. And I have a minute, so I'm going to wrap very, very quickly. Oh, my God. Okay, Amy? Yeah. No, they're giving me it. The human network is up against what? It's up against what you all know, this very, very structured and powerful architecture of censorship and control. And it's both technical, legal, social, and it's a very incredibly organized at every single level, a security apparatus, and you can see that. Okay, I'm going to just go quickly because I've gotten a minute, yeah. I can't. Because, no, go back. Go back, yeah. Go back. Okay. The regulatory framework is important because it's not only what you keep reading about, the 60-plus, you know, all of these laws that have been passed, etc. It's not just that. It's the law within a broader framework of state security, state secrets, and the criminal law, which criminalizes activities that many of you in this room would just take for granted you could do. Even, you know, if you think it's criminal, we're talking about, you'll see, I want to give you some quick examples, and then there are, this is. But I want to give you some quick examples of the state secret law, and they are, we are about to issue a report on that, and you can look for it on our website. And we're going to issue it in sections, because the state secrets law is so comprehensive, it covers every single area, health, environment, labor, security, and you won't be shocked to find out, oh, I've got competing authority telling me, one going 1 minute or you're, and I've got Eric, the lawyer, saying, take as much time as you like. So I'll be somewhere in between the two of them, 2 minutes. Okay.
I can use my time however I want. You have some.
Thank you. Thank you. So some of the examples that we'll be, you know, documenting is, for example, the number of people who protest, the number of deaths in mines, in coal mines, the number of deaths from occupational hazards, the number of people who are actually infected with AIDS, the number of deaths from SARS. These are all state secrets. Okay, next. Okay, definition of state secrets. State secrets are matters that affect the security and interests of the state. Well, that gives you a really clear definition, right? Kind of circular. But there's a classification that's really important. Top secret, right? Jimi. Highly secret, Jimi. Drimi, and then there's secret, then there's internal. The two important things about it is new regulations that went into effect allow you to reclassify based on the consequences. That means if they decide that you leaked a newspaper article, faxed it to an NGO in New York, for example, but it was a newspaper article at the time or it was public, it doesn't matter. It can be classified retroactively as a secret because it was deemed to be later so harmful to the state. So that's the catch. That's how you can catch a net that's so wide you can get anybody. And in fact, they have. And these are cases that I know our colleague Bill Shah has already talked about, and I just wanted to just throw them out and just have you see that these are just a few of the cases. And Amnesty has said 61. We've documented others, and in part of our casework, we do a lot of advocacy at the UN on behalf of individual cases, and internet activists are among a big group. We brought some copies of, this is our English language journal, which I presume most of you would prefer this to the Chinese. So it's the China Rights Forum, and the red issue focuses on internet activists and journalists, and there's a chart of internet activists and journalists who were imprisoned at the time, and we have some copies, and Gabe is here from us, and Amy, my colleague here, and we also have copies. If you want, we also brought the most recent issue, which is on the 15th anniversary of the crackdown, because we really don't think people should forget, and we can't forget, and we are going on with our work for that. Okay. The consequence of all of this, and I like the way Bill Shah talks about it as, you know, the matrix effect in China, because within the matrix, everyone believes it's reality. And that's one of the consequences inside China is that it's not only created a censorship and self-censorship, it's not only created a climate and a culture of fear, and it's also undermined the capacity of a whole country and a whole society to come up with the solutions, because solutions don't get generated if information isn't available and if people are threatened, because the complex problems that are facing China needs all of its people, and it can't have them silenced. I really believe that's what it takes to deal with China's problems. And so the consequences of the censorship, it's really undercutting themselves. Did you know that during the Great Leap Forward in China, which was disastrous, and millions, I think 20 million people starved to death because of the disastrous policies of the party, that when Mao made his tour around the countryside to see what the situation was, they painted the trees because people starve so badly. Starvation is not a pretty picture, so if you want to read about it, Hungry Ghosts is the most powerful book written about it, Hungry Ghosts by Jasper Beckers. But they, Hungry Ghosts. People scraped the bark off trees because there's nothing to eat, and they made buns with dirt just to fill their stomach. But when Mao went through the countryside to see what the situation was, they painted the trees brown. So from when he went the tour, you couldn't see that, in fact, that was the real situation. And what I think is they didn't learn their lesson. If you lie and you don't let information get out, you're not going to get the solution to deal with it. And frankly, they didn't learn their lesson from SARS either. But all of this is not new, and that's really important. All that has happened in China's authoritarian state is it got a technological upgrade. All of the technology of repression was a lower end, but it was very effective during the Cultural Revolution. It has always been effective, and that's important to remember. Okay. This is all stuff I think you've all been talking about, but some of the empowering role of technology is that it can amplify the dissident voices and activist voices. It can generate the global support and attention we need. It can create the underground railroads. It can create the underground tunnels. And we need you to help us create them. And we need them to create a flow of uncensored information within China and in and out of China. And we need to help create the virtual spaces for Chinese citizens to meet and organize. And we need to create the shared resource libraries where they can access it and get it online. But all of this role of technology and all of these strategies has to be grounded in a material reality of China today. I'm just going to very quickly talk about our approach, and maybe I'll talk more about it in the Q&A because I'm out of time. Yeah. This is the cluster of the websites that we're building, and we could use a lot of help building them. It's all being redesigned, both front-end and back-end, so if you visit us in about a month or 6 weeks, you're going to see the new launch of the new site. It's going to be much more interactive, and it will be much more accurately reflect the range of what we're trying to do, which is really quite cutting-edge, and the current site doesn't reflect that, so I'm just saying that as a caveat. But I'm going to talk about the Huaxia Dianzibao. It is it's a part of a very big, ambitious initiative. And what it is we use two methods, two technological solutions, and we send in 350,000 emails into China a week. And it's a newsletter that we compile from edited stories and censored stories that we get from inside China that people send us that work with us. We edit it and we send it back in. So we get it. We edit it, and we send it back in. We also send in a proxy link every week, and we work very closely with Bill Shaw and others on this. And the proxy link enables them to directly access. We do channel them to us, but it also means that they can then go onto the net. And I wanted to show you just very quickly that the proxy access that's coming to us through UltraReach means it came from China, because nobody else is going to try to need to get to us from a proxy. And you see the percentage of the proxy. And you see the up and down on proxies, not only through how they try to get to us, it also means what the countermeasures have been. There were some real attacks on dissident sites just at the beginning of this year, and a lot of us took some very big hits and had to do a lot of major security work and re-security work. And we actually had to move our site, which was hosted in Hong Kong, out of our Hong Kong operations. And we had to move everything because it became very insecure. And we moved it back to the States. But this is what it shows. But if you take a look at October, this is really important. That huge jump in proxy access was the month that the lawyer that had been working with us, case, blew open, and we had put it on our site. And so people are interested and do want to know what's going on. Okay. This is some of the feedback. They can also email us. We didn't put up here the curses. We got cursed out a lot. And we also got the Public Security Bureau wrote to us and said very bad things to us. Said, you people have a blah, 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 and, you know, said death to you and all that stuff. And then we actually tracked it out. It was from them. We said, wow, it's cool. They're getting our stuff. It's not too bad, you know. And they actually took the time to write to us and all that. But this is the good feedback. We've also had people forward our email and our mail, and they forward it to the authorities, and they CC us. And so it's both to protect themselves, to show we got it, but we're going to turn you in. And so they CC us so everybody knows that they did it and all that stuff. And Amy tracks all of that. We track all of the stuff we get back from China, and we're monitoring it very carefully, and we could use some more interesting, creative ways to monitor it. But this is some of it. But the last one is we really like a lot. This was written to us by a lawyer who said, I'm just a humble lawyer in China. I read you folks regularly. We're in the 7th month of the pilot. We survived 7 months. It's an interactive technology project. That means we have to keep coming up with a different solution every week, thanks to Bill Shaw and our friends. But he wrote, one blade of grass can set the prairie ablaze. And we love that. Okay. I'm almost done. 1 minute. This is just to give you one example of some of the differences, I think, but differences that are important just to recognize so we can work together. And this is the framework how we have to think about effectiveness. And we have to think about it a little bit differently than some of that hackers may sometimes think about it. And that is, we think of it as very long term. We think of it as, what is the multiplier and ripple effect? We can't go in once. We've got to figure out how we go in and get to stay in. And how do we keep it safe for the people that are in the room that we enter in and that work with us? A lot of the people in the underground networks we work with. And so some of the factors we think of, is just to throw it out, is we think of assessing everything by time. And we try to think about comparison with other similar effects, but right now our project is one of two demos. And we are the only one, I think, right now that's truly an independent project. And we think of our reader feedback. We think of the multiplier effect. We have to think about costs, because And I am particularly aware of cost because as the executive director, I spent a lot of my time begging for money. I didn't know I was such a good beggar and shameless. You know, it's just very sad to always be begging for money. But that's what I do. And I found out that I've become shameless and I beg for money. And I always, people say, what part of no don't you get? And I'll say, well, could you maybe think about giving us this much then? And they're going, no. I'll say, well, how about we come back next month? They go, no. And then I keep doing that. So we think of cost. And we think of cost because we have to pay for what we do, and we really have to pay the bills. So I just want to end with this, which is to first build on that and say, so let's go on and build some really kick-ass alliances because what we're up against is so hard. And we do that with respect for and recognition of that we do have some different goals, and we may have some different approaches, and we may have some different cultures, and we may operate in some very different material realities, and that while breaking into a room can be a wonderful exercise of freedom and a statement about kick it open, we also think that for us, one of the purposes is let's break into the room and then let's ask the question why. And we need to answer that question, that it has to be sustainable. We have to be able to empower the people in the room so that they can kick down those walls and build other kinds of houses and rooms and spaces. And we have to think about security. And we have to think about pushing the envelope at the same time. How far can we push it? Because the consequences for what we do and the people we work with is really life and death. So join us. Help us even out the odds. And I'm going to end with a wish list of what we would need and like. And the wish list is not inclusive and complete, but just to get you thinking, you know. We need training, and we need helping to build the technical expertise in-house in our capacity. Anybody who wants to train us to unlock doors, we're there. Anything, we need to increase our technical expertise. We need pro bono support and maintenance for some of the systems that have been designed for us, but we have no maintenance. We need, and here's a job opening. So if you want to take a pay cut for anyone who's doing six figures as a software engineer, but do a good thing with your life, we need a web programmer. We've been searching for one for over a year. We desperately need one. We need tech hacker interns. We need interns. Gabe is our intern now, and boy, did it make a huge difference to have him rewriting programs, redoing leads assessment, and we're not letting him go back to school. So his mother's very upset because I said, quit school. School? What school? Who cares? You're changing the world. Who cares about that BA? But it's not a good idea. We have a whole bunch of special IT projects that are very particular. So I'd rather talk to people who are interested in contributing anything and talk to us about that. Amy's here. Amy is the internet manager of all of these initiatives I've been talking about. And Gabe is not going anywhere till the end of, he's in bondage until end of August. And he'll be here to talk to you. So thank you so much. So join us. Thank you.